Yes.
Hi, you're listening to Fated Mates, episode one, book one, A Hunger Like No Other. I'm Sarah McLean. I write romance novels. I read romance novels.
I'm Jen. I read romance novels, and I talk about them a lot on Twitter.
So we're going to talk about them a lot in your ear holes.
Ew.
Is that not sexy?
It's not sexy. No.
All right, I'll take them out of my next book.
Okay.
So this podcast, if you listen to the first episode, which is numbered 0.5, because it was really just a introduction to us and to our obsession with Cressley Cole's Immortals After Dark series, you know that we are going to do, this is basically a read-along podcast. Like, we hope you've read the book, or you're planning to read the book, or you're thinking about reading the book, or maybe you just like the dulcet tones of our voice in your ear holes.
See, I feel like now you're going to say, like, moist, and nipple, and ear hole, all the
do
words
you have
I don't
least
like.
Favorite word?
Nipple.
Nipple is your least favorite? Really?
Yeah, and I don't know why.
Do you prefer things like nubbin? I should also say I poured myself a glass of wine for this one because it's going to get real.
Yeah. I'm not sure there's like a better word for it, though. That's I think.
It's like straining tip. I mean, as somebody who has written, we're just diving right in, you guys.
Right in. Welcome to our show.
I feel like this is how we get romance readers to really sign on.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Yeah. There's no way around it. It's not like moist. You can come up with different words.
Sure. Dewy.
Sweet rain.
Okay. Now that was just mean. I'm sure we'll get to sweet rain. I like to think we'll get to sweet rain somewhere around the time that we'll get to sweet ruin, because I feel like
well done.
Maybe it's all connected.
Bring it right back.
But that's, you know, that's for a future show.
Okay. So last time you did actually introduce this book. So I think we both reread it for this event. Do you want to do like a brief overview of like the plot for those of you who are just joining us and have not read the book?
So to set the scene, this is the first book in Immortals After Dark. So we really know nothing going into it. Except in chapter one, we meet our hero, Lachlan McReeve, who the McReeves will become very important over the course of the next 18 books. So remember that last name. It will be back. And Lachlan is a werewolf, as one is, and he is trapped in the catacombs below Paris, and it's understood that he's been trapped there for at least 100 years, probably closer to 200. And he has been trapped in eternal flames, bound by mystical, witchy chains, enchanted chains.
Enchanted.
If you will. I can never remember that word.
Witched. It's a verb.
Witched chains. He has been tortured endlessly because all of, as one might imagine from the series title, all of the characters in this series are immortals. So they can't die unless, you know, something quite serious happens to them. And apparently being ritually murdered by fire is not one of those ways. So he is down there and, you know, just down there, tortured by his arch enemies, the vampires. And suddenly he scents above him on the streets of Paris a woman who he instantly recognizes as his mate. And he, in absolute, because he's waited 1,000 years for this woman to turn up, he does everything that he can to get out of these witched chains, including gnawing off his leg, which does regenerate. So it's fine, ultimately.
It's all fine.
It's fine. But there is a piece of this book where he's hobbling down the Champs-Élysées after his fated mate.
Bride without a head.
A wolf without a foot.
Who happens to be, of course, he thinks, a vampire. I mean, she is part vampire, but.
Yeah. Now, she's interesting. Her name is Emmeline Troy. And Emma, he calls her for most of the book. And Emma, I want to, can I put a pin in us talking later about the nods to Greek mythology? Okay.
Yeah, because I want to have a real talk about Fury, too.
Yes, there's a lot to unpack in this one. So the thing that's really interesting about this is Emma is, for an immortal, is very young. She's only 70-something. But of course, she looks like she's 23, and she recently graduated from Tulane. She's a co-ed, which I actually highlighted because it's such a funny, old-fashioned, I was like,
2004 kind of word.
Do we still use that word? Co-ed? Okay. And... great. Here I am.
It was a kinder, gentler time.
Sure. Exactly.
To be fair. I mean, we are recording this on a day, you guys. So
yes, it's true. It's true. And she is, you know, it's interesting. I think that we are going to talk a lot about this book, like sort of for its plot, but also what we think it's trying to do. And Emma very much presents at the beginning of the book as a type of heroine that in Romancelandia has a pretty unkind moniker, right? Like too dumb to live.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you say that because I don't know that I would label her as too stupid to live. I think I would label her more as like a Mary Sue at the beginning of this book.
Interesting. Okay.
I think she's crafted this way. And we're going to,
yes.
I know we're going to talk about this, but I think Cressley Cole, there was absolutely, I know this because I've read the books that came before this from Cressley's pen. And I've read all the books that came after it too. And there's no way she wrote a Mary Sue. And then we instantly sort of see that she's not really.
So I was rereading as well, right? I know we both did. And there's a part where, Emma sort of self-names, like it's page 302, right? She wasn't too stupid to live. She was too far gone to care, is what it says. Talk about maybe what you think is the difference between a Mary Sue and a, like, the too stupid to live trope. Should we start with talking about Emma, or do you want to start with talking about Locke?
Well, wait, I also think, like, I just want to tie up the loose end of this, the book itself and the plot. Basically, every book in this series... And I think that's true. I mean, when we get to one that's not like this, I'll have to mea culpa a little bit. But every book in this series is basically at its core trope a fated mate story. Because every member of the lore has one single fated mate over the course of his or her lifetime.
Although, wait, that's not true for the...
Oh, see, here we go. Well, no, we're going to get to it.
Yeah, that's true.
I know.
But for vampires and for the Lyce, for sure, there's fated mates.
Yes. The story is, of course, the internal conflict of the story, and we're going to talk about this over the course of the podcast, but there are two kinds of conflict, internal conflict and external conflict. And the internal conflict is all the, like, emotional, like, drama, and the external conflict is all the, like, world-building, like, crazy, everything is it, everybody's at war, the whole thing is falling apart around them kind of conflict. But this book is really interesting because the internal conflict is that the hero knows for a fact that the heroine is his fated mate. She does not know that she is his mate instantly because there has never been such a thing as a female vampire. At least all the female vampires that anybody – people believe that female vampires have basically died off. So there is no evidence that female vampires have a fated mate. And then on top of it, there is this sort of – it's sort of a perfect revenge story where he has been chained by these vampires under Paris and tortured for years because the vampires and the werewolves are mortal enemies. And Emma is a vampire who may or may not be related to the people that he – that have tortured him. So there's hatred and anger and real fury – from Lachlan's perspective at the beginning of the book. And then Emma really starts to evolve into a place where she too feels hatred and anger. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really beautifully done. So that is the sort of overarching theme of this book. It's a revenge story and a fated mate story.
Well, and I think I think one of the things about this book that I think is interesting is it really does play too, though, with a lot of what I think of as being really classic tropes. you know, she's young, she's a virgin, she doesn't really believe in her own strength or know her own strength. So, you know, even though she's more worldly than him in some ways, because of course he's been trapped in the catacombs for 150 years, she's like innocent in ways. And I do think that's really purposeful because...
And has been kept in the dark.
Yes.
By many, many, many people around her, which starts to become very clear to the reader, I think, before it starts to become clear to Emma, that the whole world is kind of conspiring against her in not in a cruel, intentional way. Or, I mean, it is intentional, but not in an intentionally cruel way. In a way that, you know, they sort of think Emma is too soft to be able to deal.
Right. And she thinks that about herself. She doesn't think of herself as having any kind of strength. And I think that it's interesting, this her arc, right, of finding her inner strength is very interesting to me, but also was sort of unexpected. Because when she does first start out, when we first meet her, she is kind of annoying. And I don't typically find heroines annoying, but I found her really passive in a way that I really, in the first 50 pages, sort of struggled to understand why she was acting the way she was acting.
I think that that's in part because Lachlan feels like such an asshole.
Oh, and yeah.
So, and here's where we're going to talk about it. So we are recording this show on, what's the date? On October 1st. For those of you who are listening to the show, you will know if Brett Kavanaugh has been confirmed to the Supreme Court or not, which is kind of wacky to think about. But right now we are, what, 3 days, 4 days out from the Kavanaugh testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And my heart is full of rage.
Yes.
And
yes.
So what's interesting is I reread this book before the Kavanaugh hearings, and I thought to myself, like, oh, you know. So I think we talked about this last episode, but I came to Immortals After Dark 2 years ago, maybe three, maybe 2.5 years ago, and I read all 18 books in 2 weeks. And I was obsessed from the start of A Hunger Like No Other. And then I did not – A Hunger Like No Other is a book that I have not read again until now because I have other favorites in the series.
Okay. And I want to talk about – before you continue, I want to talk about my experience, which is I read it when it first came out, right? Like, so 2006 or something, and then reread it last year at some point. But then I have a romance book club at 57th Street Books in Chicago, and this was one of the books we read this summer. And so I read it again just post Me Too, and it read differently. And I will tell you, it was not – now, there's a lot of new romance readers in my group, people who've maybe only read historical or are my friends and come because they like me. And this book was a real struggle for a lot of them. They felt it was very – like Lachlan was such a jerk. And some of these are friends who, are very impacted by the Me Too movement and just felt really like, I can't believe you're asking me to read this because it feels a little rapey. And so even then, me rereading the first 50 or so pages since Thursday – like, so it's amazing how my temperature with this book changes given what's going on in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I reread last month and definitely saw the first. And when we talk about Lachlan's behavior, I want to be very fair because I think, and I know Jen feels this way and I want her to talk about it, but I believe very strongly that Cressley did a lot. And I should also preface this with, I don't know Cressley. and so I don't know anything that I say about, anytime I say that, I I just mean, like, as a writer, this is how I feel. I believe that Cressley intentionally drew a character who behaves the way Lachlan does in the first 50 pages so that she could show his evolution.
Absolutely, I believe that. It doesn't make that first 50 pages any less painful.
No, it doesn't. And so I should say, if you haven't read this book or you are coming back to this book with us during this podcast, the first 50 pages are probably going to read a little different to you than they did the first time you read them. And they probably will read a lot problematic to you now. And I want to also say this book was written in 2006. It won the Rita for Best Paranormal Romance in 2007, and we have to look at paranormal romance as a product of a time.
Yeah. And I think that that's the other thing that was clear to me from my, like, romance group is paranormal has a lot of very specific conventions to that subgenre that if you're not familiar with – it can seem very jarring, right? I'm so familiar with paranormal that I know where to put, like, sort of, right? I know how to, like, trace that against the things I already know. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of my friends, it was like, whoa.
What am I reading?
Yeah, exactly.
Especially because when you think about people who haven't come to paranormal romance through romance, through the romance route, they've usually come to it through Twilight. And the vampire experience in Twilight, the paranormal experience, is very much like two kind of beta heroes fighting over the heroine instead of what is happening here. And what happens particularly in these romance series, the longstanding romance series that have existed since, post 9/11, that were written in the early and mid 2000s, these heroes are deeply alpha. And I mean,
oh, yes.
I mean, deeply alpha to the point, and alpha to the point of, in this particular case, like, the hero is a werewolf whose entire mentality is pack mentality. Aside from fated mate, it's pack and protection. But for the first 50 pages, there's also a lot of, the way Cressley codes the alpha in this first 50-page experience is not just pure alpha with a pack protective mentality, which is the kind of alpha that we see now in romance in 2018, but an alpha with pack protection, fated mate experience, a kind of mine alpha, the kind of hero who constantly thinks, like, she's mine, she's mine, she's mine, she belongs to me, but also a hero who is in a pure rage about the fact that she is his mortal enemy. Mm-hmm. By virtue of being a vampire, and also has been chained without food, and chained and tortured without food or any other, like, human — I use human in a sort of vague way.
Right, right.
Human interaction for 150 years. So when he comes out, he's literally beyond his own control, which sounds like I'm forgiving his behavior, and I'm not. I'm just trying to sort of frame these first 50 pages in terms of,
like, what to expect.
Motivation.
Yeah. Right. In light of the Kavanaugh hearings, very uncomfortable. Very the sort of, I deserve this because I've been promised it.
Yeah, you are my fated mate, and therefore you should submit to me, is really interesting. But Emma immediately has power even within those first,
interactions. Absolutely.
Yeah. And she instantly there are some very specious moments, but then she basically says, like, you're not allowed to, we're not going to have sex. We're not going to be physical. We're not going to interact this way until I want it. And they sort of make this deal that he won't ask for it until she asks for it. And it's not him who makes the deal. She basically sort of determines the,
like, sets those boundaries, right?
Which I like. I think that's an interesting choice, because certainly over the course of romance history, the alpha who says, I won't take it until you ask for it, is ubiquitous.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, like, my, like, funny, like, Lachlan's such an alpha that he's able to drive a car just he learns to drive a car just by watching her do it for one day, right?
Well,
I mean,
why
you
not?
Know.
But she said, but there, that's a perfect example. So Cressley is hilariously funny. You know, her voice is incredibly funny. And there's that moment where he does learn to drive a car. He says, well, I'm preternaturally strong and yes. brilliant, and therefore I must be able to learn to drive one of your, like, silly vehicles. I mean, there's a sort of charm.
She's outraged. She's like, is it really that you just, that D for drive? I mean, it's sort of this very funny moment.
So, I mean, I feel this way. And then it's chapter 11, really, that is the turning point in my mind. And what happens during chapter 11 is they've been together for, it's about 100 pages. They've been together for about 100 pages. And Lachlan has started to calm down. And he started, when we're in his POV, we start to sort of see him realize that, like, Emma is this, like, calming influence on him, which is what
yes.
mates should be to each other. And the happily married person in me is like, oh, I really love that as, like, the message of me, like, this sort of, like, we balance each other. But anyway, aside from all that, they have not had sex. They are not having sex. And he comes in and he's protecting Emma. There are a couple of moments where he starts, like, the sun starts to rise and he's watching her sleep and he thinks to himself, oh my God, I have to save her from the sun, right? Because she's a vampire. So we've sort of seen, like, cracks in his facade. And then, and Jen is not going to be surprised by this at all, because food is my love language. And he tries to wake her up to go somewhere. They're going
yes.
to Scotland to his estate. And she's like, no, I need to sleep. And she's clearly not well. And, like, immortals don't get sick. So what's wrong with her? And he says, are you, you know, what's wrong with you? And she refuses to answer. And he touches her and she's ice cold. And he says, he's like, you're in his point of view, and he is crazy. Like, he can't bear the fact that, like, she's sick in front of him. And he says, what's wrong with you? And she says, I'm hungry. And instantly the sort of beast inside him is, you know, horrified that his mate is going hungry.
And he didn't know.
He couldn't sense it. He didn't notice. And so instantly he's like, you have to eat. And of course she's a vampire. So, like, she has to eat from him. And this moment where he's where he chooses to bear himself to her and allow his mortal enemy, the vampire, to feed directly from his body is really powerful. And so there's this whole moment, and I'm, of course, like, this is where I start to, like, even now, in the middle of Will Kavanaugh be confirmed,
right.
I'm, like, melting away at this moment, because for me food is so id. At the end of it, like, the whole experience of eating for both of them is deeply sexual. Like,
oh yeah,
he gets instantly hard the moment she penetrates him, which I think is a really interesting, like, for the first book in a series. This
yes.
kind of, there's suddenly, like, all my, like, feminism bells are going off, right? Like, she penetrates him, he gets hard, and then she just starts to, like, glow. She becomes deeply, deeply healthy. And in her healthiness, in her health, she starts to get super sex positive. Like,
yeah,
she gets
absolutely.
Real sexy. She gets really into sex. She starts to, like, grind on him. She starts to, like, take control of their interaction. And then after she's finished eating, she pulls out of him and then punches him in the face and dislocates his jaw.
Yes.
And I, at this point, am wedded to Cressley Cole forever. Like, it's just such a perfect, perfect transition from ancient romance to modern romance. And now I'm going to let Jen talk.
Well, I think, you know, it's funny because I wanted to, like, I think one of the things I'm really interested in is sort of, like, what's the, like, most memorable or best scene in any book, right? Like, the thing that you really are, like, when I think about this book, it's this. And for me, it's always going to be this scene as well. Along with the scene where they, like, mate for the first time, which we can talk about too. But I think the other big part of it is, you know, for 100 pages, Lachlan's just been raging, right? He's so furious. He can't believe that she's his mate. And he just takes and takes and takes from her in so many ways. And this is really the first moment where we see him giving, right? And so it's like this sense of, I mean, and you know, the things he's taken from her, it's like her freedom of movement, her money, her, right? Like there's, right, you know, her sort of sense of her of being safe in the world. And so now in this sense where he realizes it's not just that she has to feed, but I can feed her. And then very quickly, no one will ever feed her again but me, right? And that this is something that he has always thought of as being abhorrent. And now it's profoundly, like emotionally, like sexually, physically, in all those ways really moves him. And I think that this is like this really important moment where we see him, I don't know, for the first time, like accepting that her being a vampire isn't just something to be, he has to bear, right? It's something that they're going to make something new out of it together. And I think that there's something really appealing about that. Like, so yes, it's like this incredibly sexy moment, but I also think emotionally it's really charged for him to give to her after he has just been sort of taking. And I think that's like the thing we talked about, like a character's arc. What I'm really interested in is, you know, you talked about that transition from like old to new, right? Old school romances are all about the patriarchy, right? About the hero getting everything from the heroine, about getting what he wants from mine. And this is like also a moment where he realizes, like, if he really is going to be with her, it's going to be something new they create together that literally no one has ever experienced this before, because there's never been a female vampire.
And certainly not a female vampire who's been allowed to mate freely, right?
Right.
Female vampires are valuable, incredibly, incredibly valuable, which is another piece of this sort of the external plot of this is Emma's a danger to herself by virtue of being the only one of her kind.
Like literally they don't even know anything about her, right? Like, I mean, even at some point, there's a lot of anger I feel towards her coven of Valkyries for, because she's half Valkyrie, half vampire, for not giving her the information she needs. But at some point it becomes clear there's so much they don't even know. It's not that they purposefully kept things from her. It's that they didn't know either.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because when I just want to say one more thing about Lachlan in that moment and that sort of evolution. But I think a lot often about, I saw Alicia Rye on a panel, at BEA this year in New York in May, and it was a panel on toxic masculinity, and somebody asked the question about alphas, like what is an alpha? Like can alphas exist in 2018, and like what do we want an alpha to be? You know, how do we reconcile the experience of the alpha? And Alicia, I thought, made a really important point about alphas, that it's not enough to just be like strong and domineering and controlling and protective of what is yours. A true alpha, in terms of a valued alpha in the romance world, is a character who caretakes, which I think is part of what has evolved, why the sort of BDSM romance has evolved so strongly from arguably like the paranormal died off or at least quieted down, and BDSM books rose in the immediate aftermath of that. And that caretaking experience, and this is part of why so many of the writers of BDSM books were so livid about poor representation of the BDSM community in books. But there's that caretaking piece is so much a part of the dominant submissive world.
Right.
And what's interesting about what Cressley is doing is she's writing, and we're going to get to and do an episode on the Game Maker series, which has a lot of those themes in it. But what Cressley does so well is harness that caretaking experience. And also from a writer's perspective, doing it in his point of view is the only choice. And I think a lot of writers probably would have made a different choice, but it's essential that scene happen in his point of view.
I agree. I absolutely agree, because he's, again, I think part of it is the time period, right? Like my experience with him, especially in this first 100 pages, is different every time I read it. But I think that part of it is this sense that we have to see him changing, and we have to see that he's choosing to change, right? That arc is not convincing if she's dragging him kicking and screaming into the 21st century, right? He has to decide. And that was like the thing I point I made last week, right? Like I'm really interested in his arc, and actually in almost all of the books, in this question about like, what is modernity, right? Like, what does it mean to be modern? And I think that this for him is this moment where he realizes, hey, maybe everything I thought I knew, I didn't know, which is really her arc as well, but his is more about society and hers is really about herself. But they're very similar. I think they're like mirror images, right? Like everything I thought I knew is not what I knew. And this person is going to allow me to see myself or the world in a new way or a better way. And if I am not willing to change along with the times, then I'm a relic, right? I might as well be back underneath the catacombs of Paris.
Brilliant. Yes. Agree. I would just say also that that's going to come back again and again, particularly with the oldest characters in this series, some of whom are tens of thousands of years old. And the older the character, the more they will struggle with this modernity question, and their identity and how they can exist as they age in a young world.
Well, and I also think it's a question about like personal change, right? Like how do we, I mean, and this is sort of the fated mates thing, like, right, we're coming back to like, how do you change yourself when you're so old or, right? Like, I mean, you know, it's like hard to change, you know, anything about yourself, let alone, you know, like the more life experience you have, like backing up this idea of who you are. And I think that's it too. Like, I think Lachlan at some point metaphorically looks in the mirror and thinks, I'm someone I don't like. And if I want to be with her, I have to change. Right. Whereas Emma, it's more, hey, I'm someone I haven't liked or really, you know, and now I can be someone different. But somehow there's this path before me I didn't see there before because of my relationship with this man.
And then on top of it, the other layer of this and a layer that sort of comes back again and again, particularly with the Valkyries and the Lyke, both of whom are very like hardened like pack communities, right? The Valkyries literally all live in the same like mansion in the bayou, like outside of New Orleans, and the Lyke all live sort of in Scotland. And these two communities, they tend toward family dynamics in a really interesting way. Like, and I think what's fascinating is the interplay in the book between Emma's relationship with her aunts at home and her relationship with Lachlan, even in those early pages when he hasn't, you know, reached his full potential, where like she's on the phone with her aunts in New Orleans and they say, you know, I think there's a scene that I have marked where she says, I can take care of myself. And they laugh at her.
They
literally
laugh. Yes.
And because she's being hunted as, you know, an existing female vampire and the daughter of a very, well, is he a king? What is he?
He's the king of the vampires. Yeah, now, that's not really like spoiler alert, but whatever. It's a 15-year-old book.
No, you're there. It's also like not exactly the hardest thing to put together. So she's being hunted as both, you know, female vampire plus princess. And the vampires will start to discover over the course of the series, you know, are constantly infighting. There's a big battle as to who should be in charge of vampires. There are different factions. It's very political, but not in like a weird, like boring way, not in like a Star Wars 1, 2, and 3 way.
Right.
There are no like Senate disputes.
Well, I think of it as being very, I mean, I think the whole plot about Like, so I'm a middle school English teacher, and I like teach kids like the basics of plot, right? Like person versus person, person versus nature. And one of the ones that is like really fun to talk about with kids is person versus fate, right? Like, who are you the person that you're fated to be? Is there a way to fight that? And I think this is like a really interesting question for immortals, especially who are not part of like a clan like Emma, right? Like, she doesn't know what her fate is in terms of being a vampire and a Valkyrie because there's no one like her. Where Lachlan has this rock solid sense of what his life is supposed to be like, right? And I think bringing those differences to the table also makes for a lot of really interesting discussions, because she has to deal with his family, right? Like, once she gets to Kennevain, which is like his ancestral home, she meets, you know, his favorite cousin and, you know, the servants, this woman, Cassandra, right? Which I'm really fascinated. She was convinced that Lachlan was going to be hers and cannot believe that he's mated to a vampire. But I'm also fascinated because Cassandra, of course, is this famous, back to like Greek mythology, right? Like the name of a woman who's foretells the future, no one listens to her. And so, you know, it's hard not to think like, oh, is there some element of truth to what she's saying? Or is it just that everyone's going to ignore her because Lachlan's a king and he doesn't want to hear it.
Yeah. And I think also Cressley does a great job, like, again, in the hands, I feel like I'm going to say this every episode for 18 episodes, but in the hands of a lesser author, Cassandra would have been made into like a character of herself. And she's not. Cressley's very careful. Mm-mm. And I got to say, you guys, like in 2007, the like evil other woman was not exactly like that hard to find in romance. Now I feel like we're doing a little better, you know, weeding her out. So yeah, I mean, I also think one of the things that, and I, that sort of brings me to something that I marked over and over and over again in this book. Now, of course, knowing what's to come, it makes it, of course, easier to read the book and see what the foreshadowing is. First of all, there's masterful foreshadowing here.
Oh yeah,
I have to assume it was planned, or else she was very. She read all her books again, which I've never done.
Right.
But I would say that the thing that she establishes immediately, and again, it's something that in other paranormal series we don't see as. It's not as common, is every single character, even the worst of them, are deeply nuanced. There is, Cressley seems to have taken to heart the sort of every villain is the hero of his own story kind of adage.
Literally, by the time we get to Lothair, that's true, right?
Exactly. Lothair will come back. All the vampires will come back. And over the course of this book, you start to see evil characters who you immediately paint with a broad brush, suddenly nuanced and making choices that, you wouldn't have expected. And I think for me, and I won't spoil this, but for me, the sort of climactic scene of this book still reads as a surprise to me.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, not obviously I know it's coming, but I feel like the choices that particular characters make, evil characters right. that were painted with a broad brush make, are very fascinating, and not necessarily fascinating because those choices are made, but why they are made. Like, Cressley doesn't – it's not the easy route.
Well, and that's it. Sometimes authors, I think, like, kind of set up a certain set of things to happen, and then at the last minute – they balk, right? And they don't really have the courage of their convictions to sort of like carry it out the way the setup demands. And I think in some ways, like, my surprise was a sense of, oh wow, it's really going to happen this way, right? But more than anything else, even without like revealing any of those details, like that arc for Emma, who goes from being pretty reserved and shy, and like someone who, you know, people laugh at her when she says, I can take care of myself. That arc is rock solid.
Yeah.
And by the end, Emma saves herself.
Which is how it should be, Sarah McLean says.
Jen agrees, right? I mean, but so many times that setup is there, and yet still, right, the man comes along and saves her or like whatever.
Cavalry.
And, Exactly. And here it is, it's really, and I think it's really powerful. And I think it's the reason why ultimately this book is able to sort of crawl past that like rough beginning. And it's always, you know, like I you know, it's always going to be a really powerful story to me, because Emma's like emergence of like, hey, I am someone who can take care of myself. I have instincts, right? I know how to listen to them, and then I can, you know, sort of save myself literally now, right? Not just take care of myself, but save myself. Mm-hmm. I found it very powerful and very moving. And it's one of the things that I think is, you know, all women deserve, right? Like, I'm stronger than I thought I was.
Yeah. And I think there is some, I think anybody who comes at this book and then and sort of puts it down because Emma's such a Mary Sue, like they just can't, they can't embrace her and sort of understand her. I think often, I think first of all, many of them are putting it down before she punches yes. him and dislocates his jaw, but let's leave that aside. I do think that there's something, and I love a heroine who doesn't believe in herself. Like, I love a heroine who struggles with confidence, you know, and that probably says something about me, but I think that says something about a lot of us. Like, I think you know, I go back to that Pretty Woman, the scene where she says, you know, the bad stuff is easier to believe. I marked in this book that there's an entire chapter where, you know, the Valkyries are you know, pissing on her. Mm-hmm. Lachlan's being a jerk to her. And she's thinking, like, they don't believe in her. They don't believe in her strength. They don't think she can hack it. And she doesn't think she can either. And that sucks. And you feel for her. And I love her evolution into first, like, a deeply powerful being, strong enough to punch out a 1,000-year-old werewolf, right? Sexually, like, awake and cool with her sexuality.
Right.
She sort of comes into the Valkyrie side of herself and then ultimately stands up and makes choices about her future and her life that, like, it require a ton of bravery. All of that is incredibly well done. And I think Emma's a great character. I think this is a beautiful first book in a series, too. Like, it's really short. It's really tightly written. It lays out the story of the Accession and the lore and, like, the whole nine, the whole world.
Well, and I think it's all, like, so it's all those things, and it's a great sort of standalone story. You could just read it and enjoy it. But I think it's really, like, essentially virtue signaling for what the rest of the series, what the rest of the series will be like, which is not that, like, a strong woman will, like, take down an alpha male, because I think we all read romance because at some level we are drawn to the alpha male trope, right? But that they will make each other stronger, mm-hmm. and, like, work in a partnership and work in tandem.
Sure.
I mean, and I think that's, like, the, again, back to that whole, like, old romance, you know, sort of old school to, like, wherever we are now, is I think a lot of what romance is doing is interrogating sort of that alpha male trope and really, like, wanting to believe that we can, like, tame that, not in a way that makes that toothless, but in a way that means that, like, that strength becomes ours. We need to talk about the scene, though. I think I would really like to talk about the scene where, like, they do meet for the first time at the full moon.
Yeah, let's do it.
You know, what's interesting is, okay, so they set the deal, right? Like, sort of, like, you're not gonna want it until I say I want it. And
can I just say, can I pause?
Yeah, yeah.
I love a book that has a sex deal in it.
Oh, God, yes.
Like, Devil in Winter works for me works for a lot of people, mm-hmm. but it worked the best scene in that book. And we'll put this in show notes. If you've never read Lisa Kleypas's Devil in Winter, you should.
Yeah.
But Devil in Winter works so well because the sex deal, like, ultimately, he's so committed to holding firm on the sex deal. I love a sex deal because often it's what unravels an alpha.
Yes, right? Because the boundaries, I don't know. Like, I think the boundaries are so always, I don't know how to say it, right? Like, they didn't know that it would unravel them. Otherwise, they wouldn't have agreed to it, but they did, right?
Well, and it's also the sort of battle between, like, the sort of most primitive, like primeval version of ourselves and the most elevated version of ourselves. It's like nobility yes. versus id, you know, and those two things cannot coexist. And so one must win out over the other. And part of the joy of the romance novel is watching, you know, the hero in many cases, like,
yeah,
become the vision of himself that the heroine believes he can be. You make me want to be a better man.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly it. And I think this is especially powerful for Lachlan because he didn't even know that the man Emma wants him to be existed when he went into the catacombs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So he's like, it's like this really dramatic game of catch up for him. But I think the thing that the full moon, the reason this is so, there's like a timeline, right? There's a deadline. There is a big gong at the end of this, right? Because he knows that at the full moon, he's not going to be able to control like the werewolf, right? The Lyca part of himself.
And we should also say, we're not talking about, he doesn't become a furry beast.
Yeah.
In fact, that's very like covered in the book.
extensively. It's just more like almost like an apparition, right? Like almost a projection of like this inner being that he shares his, right? It's called letting the beast out of its cage is what it's called, right? And the thing that's really interesting about this scene is Emma, who is a Valkyrie and a vampire. So she's like, I'm going to take off. Like she like knocks him out and is going to try and run away. And instead it becomes this like epic chase scene through the woods at night. And the thing that's really fascinating to me is that through this blood, like bond that they share, because she drinks him, she has like a instincts and they come full force mm-hmm. at this moment. So it's another moment where, right, like they are kind of equals. She doesn't just take what he is dishing out that night, right? Like she also feels and is urged to act certain ways based on these instincts that she has sort of essentially like learned from him. And I thought that that was a really smart way of doing it, right? Like she's not just like sort of like, oh, I'm running through the woods and he's chasing me. Like there's something really primal about this sort of being chased and leading him into this like to the woods. And she, at one point she describes like how the moon felt to her. And it was, you know, it's clear. And I really appreciated the sense that like he's changing for her, but she's also changing for him. And it felt to me, at least, I don't know, it's a scene that worked for me in a lot of ways, except for a science-y nitpick, which I can talk about in a minute if you're up for a little nerd talk.
Sure. Sure, let's do it.
Yeah, so I mean, that part I think is like really interesting. And then there's this other part, though, that's kind of funny, is one of the ways that a Lyca, like when they finally mate, he like marks her. And only another Lyca could see this. It's, you know, it's like, it, you know, it's like a bite, essentially. And he is so overcome with lust that it's like really over the top. And later his brother is like, whoa, man, what'd you do there?
But that's like there. Okay, so over the course of this book, we are gonna come back to biting.
Yeah,
that's probably our episode title. We're gonna come back to biting because there are a lot of moments in this series. I'm sorry, not book, the series, where biting is particularly. I mean, it's incredibly sexual in these books, and it. We come back to it again and again. And it's invariably, like, it's a totally, I mean, there are scenes in the series where, like, I was unshockable me.
Yes.
Like, shocked by
choices. Are we talking about Lothair?
We're talking about Lothair.
Oh, yeah.
Which is then, like, once she broke my seal in Lothair, like, then I was fine and I wanted it in every single book. And I was never so happy as when it came back in Sweet Ruin.
Oh, yeah. It's intense.
The mating, the final mating, there is this real moment, though, where she's a virgin. And so there is, like, this sense of, like, deep fear, both in the reader and in her. And it's not fear. It's not non-consensual fear. It's fear of the unknown. It's fear of this, like, this beast that we've heard about and heard about and heard about and what would possibly happen. And again, Cressley doesn't shy away from it. Like, it hurts.
Yeah.
Like, and then, but because she has these, like, instincts, Cressley has sort of, like, figured out, she sort of figures out a way to navigate around it so that as a reader, you're sort of deeply relieved. And so is Emma. Like, you're really,
yes,
really, like, in Emma's head here. And it's really, really incredibly done.
The, like, buildup of the sexual tension between these two and then the way that it just almost shockingly sort of is over, right? I mean, it's really very, I don't know, like, to me, it's, like, another real achievement of the book is, like, sort of, like, the sense of, like, the urgency of that moment is so real for them, but also, like, I was like, these two have to do it. They've got to do it. This is the night. Like, it cannot, I cannot wait anymore.
And also, you know, like, he's so wrecked by it. Like,
oh,
he
yeah.
He doesn't want it to be that night. He doesn't want it to be the beast. He wants it to be himself. Like, this is the other thing that's really fascinating, especially with these werewolf characters, is, like, they really do feel like they're two beings. And so if one is experiencing it, the other one isn't. And so, except then, of course, when they're fated, that's not how it works, right? Like, the, everybody's pleased, everybody's satisfied.
And that, in that sense, it's new for him too, right? Like, he, and I liked that as well, right? Like, he's also discovering something new about himself as a lover because he, it's the first time he's ever been with his fated mate, just versus random whoever.
Right. I mean, it's a little bit magic hoo-ha.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Fine.
I don't have a problem with it.
It's literal magic hoo-ha. She's the only one in the world. It's magic.
I mean,
magic.
They're actually witched, all these people.
Okay, wait. Can I tell you my nerdy science thing, though?
Please, please.
So, on the night of the full moon here on Earth.
Well, first of all.
Here on Earth, Sarah, the full moon rises exactly when the sun sets. And the next morning when the full moon sets, it's like the sun rises. Like, that's what defines the full moon.
Uh-huh.
And so that, like, in the book, he's sort of like, there's this thing, like, it's like the moon set, right? And he's like, let's sleep for a few hours before the sun comes up. And I was like, no, you must get inside immediately. The sun has, the just as the
such
moon goes
a nerd.
Down. I know. And it really, I was like, come on now.
We need to have Neil deGrasse Tyson on this
yes.
podcast.
Seriously. I was like.
We'll get him on for Bowen,
I was like,
or McGreeve.
The planetary science of this moment was not properly. Right.
Maybe by the time we're doing McGreeve, we'll be so incredibly popular we could have. Wait, if you're a listener and you're a big reader and you're also an astronomer or like a planetary scientist, will you hit us up and come on for another to talk about science?
I have a similar astronomy science problem in book two. So this is apparently a recurring theme with me.
So hurry up.
Get to getting.
I think you'll probably have more when the Moria arrive hurtling through space.
On their, like, I mean, I still don't really understand what they're traveling on. Okay.
No, but for real, if you are a planetary scientist.
At least confirm that I'm correct. Although,
Correct. And also come on the show.
Yes, for sure.
Think about coming on the show for the Sweet Ruin.
Okay.
Sweet Ruin's going to be like a 4-episode
long. Sweet Ruin, I'm already preparing in my brain for. Okay.
Okay, but I want to also talk, we're coming up on the end of the show, but I want to talk just briefly. I want to, like, put some pins in people. I want to say Nyx is already, like, knucking fucks Nyx.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. So people, if you don't know, right, like, this is a Valkyrie who is a soothsayer. And it's really interesting because she's really present in this book, whereas later in the series, she's sort of, like, kind of drifts in and out and in fact disappears even, right? Like, people are trying to find her and they can't. And it was sort of great to come back and have her be someone who, like, gets on the phone with Emma and paints her nails while they talk about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But yeah, her setting up a lot of the future things is also really important. And in fact, the next book that's coming out is Monroe. And I don't know if you caught this. There's, like, a reference to Monroe's, like, fated mate is is going to be a real, I think, how do you say this word? Harridan?
A Harridan?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And I was like
a real deal Harridan. Is she? We haven't gotten to McGreeve yet. But yeah. So no. Monroe. So Monroe will come back later. We will. Yeah. We will spend some time talking about Monroe for sure.
All these. I actually have a little list, right? Like, there's all these little breadcrumbs of plot,
sure.
And a lot of them are coming from Nick's, right? About what's going to happen in future books.
Mm-hmm. And then Fury, who anybody who's a romance novel reader got to the moment. The first mention of Fury is like a throwaway line. She's the oldest. She's the primordial Valkyrie. And she has been tortured for like hundreds of years.
And essentially, it's interesting. It's very similar to Lachlan's torture, right? Except that she's underwater. So he was like being burned in fire. She's drowning, right? And so it's very much like sort of this, like the elements, right, are the one thing that can like wear these folks down.
Fury is part fury, going back to Greek mythology. So it makes sense that she would be, that her fire would be doused with water endlessly. Right?
Right.
And so what's interesting is that it becomes clear that she's been thrown down there. She was told to be tortured. Somebody sort of insisted on her torture. And that Lothair did it.
Yes. That's what Emma's told, right? Emma's like, Lothair was in charge of that, right?
Right. And what I believed in that moment, I mean, as the professional romance reader that I am, I was like, oh, well, clearly Fury and Lothair are the match. And I think this is the thing that I keep coming back to every time I read one of these books. I, as a writer, it's hard. I've been a romance reader for 30 years. And for, you know, 10 of those years, I've been a romance writer. And you can't undo the writer instinct when you're reading romance. And so typically what ends up happening is like I'm very aware of the bones of the story as we're going through. And the thing that I have loved about these books from the very first moment I picked this book up 2.5 years ago is that at the beginning, Cressley lays out all the threads. And then you in your head as a reader/writer think like, okay, this is how the threads are going to be, you know, woven together, and this is the outcome. And ultimately, in nearly every one of these books, they end in a different way than I would have ended them. The pathway is a different pathway and infinitely better than anything I could have come up with. And that's why I think they're just so delicious.
Right, because you're playing with, it's like masterful, right? You're playing with these tropes that exist that we've all seen before, that we feel like we come across them and we can see how it's all going to turn out. And then we're wrong, right? We're wrong. And yet, it's not disappointing. It's better, right?
Yeah. And I think, Fury comes back again and again and again, but she doesn't have a book, so don't get too excited. And Nyx is there, and Lothair will return, and he has what I believe is probably the biggest book of the series. Certainly the one that is most beloved, and that we will get to.
Before we sign off.
Yes.
I'm always telling my kids to read with a questioning stance. So I have all these questions. And one of the questions I really have, like, I kind of struggle with, because in ways I feel like this is profoundly feminist, but I am really bothered by the fact that the fated mate, like, instinct is something that men always recognize, and women, it's something that happens to a man, right? Like, oh, that's my fated mate. He recognizes her. And even in the entire series, I cannot think of a single book where the woman is the one who's like, you're my fated mate.
I can.
Which one is it?
Sweet Ruin.
Does she recognize? Oh, that book breaks all the rules.
It's
right?
So good.
Right. Fine.
And maybe there's another one. But also I would say, to your point, is it possible? So, okay, I'm reading Peter Pan to my daughter right now. I have a copy of it that was my mom's, that was given to her in like 1945. So I started reading this with my daughter, and I was like, I don't know what this is going to be.
Yeah.
I'm always a little nervous. But we started reading it, and there's this great scene in like chapter 2 of this ancient version of Peter Pan where Peter is telling Wendy about the Lost Boys, and he says, the Lost Boys are boys who have fallen out of their pram, and the fairies have picked them up and taken care of them, and if no one comes to find them again, the fairies take them to Neverland, and the Lost Boys live there. And she says, why are they only boys? And the answer, which I was very worried about, but now I'm very happy about, was girls are too clever to fall out of their prams.
Yes.
And I...
Fine.
So is it possible... I didn't think we would bring up Peter Pan in this first episode. But is it possible that the reason why heroes are so connected to this fate of mate ideology is because they require a mate in order to... be a fulfilled, like, whole
person,
whole person thing.
I think we're going to continue to explore this, right? Because I'm fascinated
by
it.
Well, it is the title of the podcast.
Yes, it is. Luckily for us. But that was, like, a big question, like, sort of, I think that I think that the book, like, all the books really sort of grapple with, like, what does this mean and who gets to feel this way and who doesn't? And then why, right?
And also, I mean, I have to say, fated mates is not my favorite trope. It rarely works for me.
And yet every single one of these.
I know.
Every single one of these.
Well, you know
books.
What it is? I think partially, and I mean, we are going to do this again and again, but I think partially it's that in the hands of many authors, fated mates is the excuse to get them together, and then like they're just together fighting an outside force. Whereas here, just because we're fated doesn't mean we have to like each other.
Right.
Or want to be near each other or want to interact with each other in any way, except, you know, to your point, man versus fate. Like, can you change it?
Right. Well, and I think this is the part, the antidote to this book, the antidote to sort of that fated mate, like the tyranny of that, right, is the Valkyrie's rule for falling in love, which is, you know, it's your true love when you want to run into his arms, right? And yeah, that is all about a choice, right? If this is not something that happened to you, it's something you decide. And I think that's like a really important like sort of setup for what we see going forward, which is, you know, this idea of, you know, and it's a question they ask each other. Would you run into his arms? And then when you say yes, nobody's going to argue with you anymore. I mean, that's like the, like, right? You get to essentially, it's like you just played the ace in the hole by saying, I ran into his arms. That's what I wanted.
It's beautifully done. And to your point, I don't know, like my instinct is that the sort of love is something that happens to men and love is something that the women choose in this book is that that's like deeply feminist, but I can see why it's not 100% there for me yet. But we're going to noodle this out.
We are. But I think for me, that's like a recurring theme is this one about, right? Because it is ultimately a romance, right? Like the paranormal elements of it, all of that is secondary to this question about love and what it means when we decide to be together. And I think that that's something that, you know, in a lot of ways, I like the fated mates trope because I like to, you know, I joked once in a review, it's shooting Cupid's arrows at people and then trapping them in an elevator together, right? Like what's going to happen, right? Like it's snowbound, but without the snow. And I think that that's interesting to me, but like you said, for so many people, it's just this excuse to get them together or for the man to say mine. And this is so much more compelling to me the way this all plays out.
Yay. So stick with us. Episode 2 is No Rest for the Wicked, which is Sebastian Roth, who is a turned vampire. We haven't even talked about the difference between born vampires and turned vampires, but we will
next week
or 2 weeks, whenever the next one is. And another Valkyrie, a Valkyrie assassin, Caedoran the Cold-Hearted, who hates everything.
Well, that's not really
except
true.
Except her sisters and her family.
The cold-heartedness is not that she hates things. It's that she doesn't feel anything.
Yeah. She lacks, and that's an excellent point. Yeah. She lacks emotion. And he is, and then it is the beginning of The Amazing Race, Immortals After Dark style, which is bananas fun. So
yeah, it's super fun. It's great.
Don't miss this one. It's going to be really, really fun. And it's the beginning of, truly, I believe that that A Hunger Like No Other is like Cressley, like sort of, you know, getting her sea legs. And then this is really the beginning of the lore world building that becomes yes. so critical to the whole series.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So. All right. Well, thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Jen. And where really can fun. People find you?
On Twitter at Jen Reads Romance. Or I have a website of romance recommendations at jenreadsromance.com.
And I am Sarah McLean, M-A-C-L-E-A-N. And you can find me at Sarah McLean on all the platforms.
Yes, just Google her. She's like a real person in the world.
Well, you're a real, I've met you. You're real too.
I'm a real person in the world. That's true.
But this is great. Find us on Twitter, hashtag FatedMatesPod. Tweet us, ask us questions, tell us if you're into space and want to talk about full moons. Make sure you back Jen up on full moons.
I know I'm right, everybody, but it's okay. I still welcome being told I'm right.
We can't wait to see you next time.
But that was it. I actually literally wrote it down. Nitpick. Full moon sets at sunrise all over the world. Hello.
Oh, my God.
They wouldn't have had more night. He's like, we have more night. I'm like,
yeah,
no, you don't.
I 100% get her ass don't inside. Care. Don't yeah. care.
I wrote down science! Exclamation point.